The title of the session this morning is Politics and Health in South Africa. And I think we've chosen this topic because I'm involved in health. I have a certain awareness, a certain knowledge of what goes on, but also chosen it to show you that apartheid, the system of apartheid actually affects every area of every person's life. And this is just one area in which I'm familiar, and so I'm actually able to talk about it. If I say a word you don't understand or am inarticulate, please stop me, or if you have any questions, that would be just fine. I think the first thing I need to say is that in South Africa we have a different, I'm not quite clear about your medical system here, except I find it very frightening. We have a different understanding of health, based more on the British system of health is a right, a basic human right, and that it doesn't actually therefore depend on having money, but that each person should be entitled to good health. And that it is the government's it's the government's responsibility to ensure that all citizens have some basic health care. That is the basic understanding which most people in South Africa would live under, but that's not fulfilled at all. About 95% of our health care is carried out by the government. We have very little private medical care going on, and the only people who would have that accessible to them would be a few rich white people. So there might be two or maybe three hospitals in South Africa which are privately run. The rest are all government-run hospitals. These hospitals are, I think, as good as any hospital in the Western world. We have the technology that America has. We have the technology that Britain has. I don't know if any of you are in the medical field at all, and if you read any medical research, but South Africa is in the front line of most medical research. The first heart transplant was done at the hospital where I trained, at Groote Schuur. We're now doing liver transplants at that hospital. They're now doing heart-lung transplants. So there's no lack of high-powered curative care going on. And in fact, the majority of patients who have the heart-lung transplants are West Germans, who cannot get the operation done in West Germany, so come to South Africa where we pay for it. I trained at Groote Schuur Hospital for 4 years as a physical therapist and then went to Britain for a year to study, to do postgraduate studying. And just, I think, I had to work through quite a lot there because I stopped working basically on the Monday, well, not quite. I stopped working in South Africa on the Friday and I started working in Britain on the Monday. And I was absolutely amazed that the same treatments that I'd been doing in South Africa on the Friday, I was doing in Britain on the Monday. And that led me to ask the question, is the patient population the same in Britain as it is in South Africa? And the answer is no. So then the question is, so are the patient needs in South Africa the same as they are in Britain? And again, the answer is no. So then it's quite obvious, are we in South Africa actually meeting the needs of our patient population? And I think that answer is no. And I think that's why I've entitled the session Politics and Healthcare, to bring out some of the ways in which apartheid is played out in our health system in South Africa. I think there's just 3 points I want to write down on the board, which are all to do with health care. The first is that health is almost like a microcosm in some aspects of the rest of South African society, and it's in health care that we see very clearly the dilemma of South Africa being both a first world and a third world country. It's in health care that it's so obvious that white people, the first world, who represent the first world in South Africa, suffer from the diseases of over-sufficiency, over-indulgence. we have all the high blood pressures, we have the heart attacks, we have the strokes. Whereas for the rest of the population, the diseases are the diseases of the third world, the diseases of poverty, diseases of tuberculosis, diseases from lack of immunization, diarrhea, lack of sanitation. So we have these two very conflicting problems in healthcare. And I think the other thing, so that's the first point I wanted to make. And then the second thing is that apartheid is really played out in healthcare when people are actually at their most vulnerable because they're ill. You know, when you're sick, you don't actually have a choice. If you're very sick, you have to go to hospital. We might have the most wonderful hospitals, and we do, but most of them, in fact, all of them except one, are racially segregated. So that in Johannesburg, which is the big industrial center in the Transvaal, a few years ago they finished building the biggest hospital in the Southern Hemisphere, costing maybe 200 million rand, what's that, $100 million, when the rest of the Western world was saying big hospitals actually don't work. We went ahead and built the biggest hospital in the whole of the Southern Hemisphere, and it's for whites only. So today, the Johannesburg General, as it's called, stands half empty. They haven't got the staff to staff it. They haven't got the patients to fill it, because there are not enough white people to fill it. Whereas down the road is the black hospital, the Hillbrow Hospital, which is totally overcrowded. There's four patients for every one bed. So there's usually two patients in a bed and two on the floor. There's an enormous lack of facilities, so that if, say, a person comes in who's had a head injury, they won't there have the equipment to actually do a CAT scan to see what's going on inside his head, so that person would have to be transported to the white hospital to have that snazzy x-ray done and then transported back. And it's only if you've got some rare and wonderful medical disease that's worth writing down that you'll actually be taken over to the white hospital. And then I think possibly one of the worst, and not only are these black hospitals totally overcrowded, and there's a constant demand on beds. There's patients just pouring in all the time, but also they're understaffed. And there was a huge outcry at the beginning of this year because they took sisters from this hospital, took black sisters from this hospital to the white general hospital to run that hospital because they couldn't find the white sisters to do that.
When you're saying sisters, are these like nuns, or is that your word for nurses?
That's a nurse. That's a qualified nurse who'd run a ward. Okay. Yeah, sorry. And then, so that's apartheid when people are just so vulnerable. And the third thing I wanted to mention was how healthcare is actually used in covert violence. And what I mean by that is we tend to think of covert violence, people actually being shot, people being beaten up, people being tear gassed. But it's actually also in the hospital that this kind of violence is happening. It's at our hospitals where research is done on torture for the state. It's at our hospitals that research is done on the effects of tear gas, how to make it better, how to make it more effective. It's at our hospitals that that information is not allowed out. So that if people are tear gassed, nobody's actually quite sure about this substance that they use. So nobody's quite sure whether you should cover your face with water or not. Also, in times of trouble, like in 1985, it was a time of great unrest. The police were, youths were taking control of streets, burning houses, that kind of thing, and they were being shot by the police. If those people were taken to hospital, they would have been arrested at the doors of the hospital. so that people wouldn't go to hospital and would die rather than go to hospital and then be arrested with a 15-year sentence. So you just had to have a bullet wound on you when you arrived in hospital and you would be placed immediately under arrest. So that's why I say it's not only that health is sort of undercover, but it's also very covert. Yes.
Could you explain a little more how hospitals are used to research torture?
Well, you know, it's not very widely known. It's just some of the equipment that's used, some of the chemicals used, are actually researched, even at Groote Schuur, which is considered the most liberal hospital in South Africa. I don't know any more about it. There's just, because everything you just hear by word, there was an instance of somebody was admitted from prison to Groote Schuur with what appeared to be thalidomide poisoning, and he disappeared 2 days later. That's the kind of thing that's going on. Also the effects of prolonged, like hours spent on your feet, beating on the feet, electrotherapy, that kind of thing is also researched at the hospitals. Right. I thought then, just going to say that it's not as if the first medicine practiced in South Africa was white Western medicine, as we tend to call it when we're generalizing it. The first medicine practiced in South Africa or in Africa was, of course, performed by the witch doctors, the traditional healers, the herbalists. And even today, educated black people will first rely on the witch doctor, the herbalist, the traditional healer, before they actually come to the doctor. And this for me was quite a surprise. I only realized that this year when one of our nutrition workers, she's actually did 2 years training to become a sister working in a hospital, 2 out of 4. So she's got 12 years of schooling, these 2 years of training. She's worked with us as a nutrition worker for 4 years. And her youngest daughter of 2 was ill, and this daughter was taken first to the traditional healer before she came to one of the doctors. And I was very surprised. I said, Kelly, I can't believe it. I really thought you're the person who teaches all your mothers. She runs a nutrition clinic. You teach your mothers all the time about dehydration and diarrhea. Why did you take your daughter Nomapondo first to the traditional healer? She said, no, Marion, you don't understand. We always go first to the traditional healer. And it's only when the traditional healer fails that we'll go to a Western doctor. So that's somebody who's lived in an urban environment for a long time. The next people who brought, who introduced...
Question, has there been any research done on the success rate of the traditional healers and the herbalists?
Yes, there has, although it's actually very difficult to penetrate that. Mm-hmm. It's very closely guarded. It is a witch doctor, you sworn to secrecy, and there's tremendous belief in evil spirits, and to divulge information, you'd be running the risk of being tortured, I don't know if that's the right word, by evil spirits for a long time afterwards. So little information has come out. But that which has, there are some cures which are fairly easy to discount because there's no ways that they can possibly work. But there are others that are actually very successful and have worked for a long time. Yeah. The next people who brought medical care to South Africa were the missionaries and introduced a very sort of a paternalistic idea about healthcare, which we still suffer from. People were made to feel responsible to the missionary who could make them better, give them an injection, give them a wonderful pill, and they'd be better. So people tended to put their health in the hands of somebody else. And that's a problem that is still very much a problem today. And it's not as if it's just a health problem, it's a social problem and a political problem, that people have had responsibility taken away for so long that it's a case of they now need to actually claim that back. The government encourages this paternalistic attitude, this relying on the myth of white Western medicine by not educating people. And by doing this, they actually control health and therefore control people's lives to a tremendous extent. You can imagine if a population is ill, is sick, is full of TB, that they're actually not that able to rise up and revolt. And it's a very subtle way of actually controlling a population. The trend of, and now if we think about today, so thinking about the witch doctors and then the missionaries, and now the fact that the government, where's the government going in medicine today? And I think that's what a lot of people my age are very critical about. Where is healthcare going in South Africa? Because the trend of medicine is like the trend it is here, like the trend it is in Britain. It's curative. We want to actually cure you. So you can have a terrible motor car accident and come in with both legs broken, 8 ribs fractured, and a head injury, but no problem, we'll fix you up. So we can actually save your life, but the trend of medicine is not concerned at all with the quality of life. And what is really needed in South Africa, I think you can understand, you know, if you're dealing with a first world population, yes, you can emphasize curative health care. That is actually all that's needed. But if you're dealing with a third world population where the diseases are completely different, you actually also need to talk a lot about preventative health, preventative medicine. Because there's no point in fixing up somebody and sending him back to exactly the same place so he's going to come in a week later. I remember when I was a student working on the orthopedic wards, dealing with people with fractured bones. And there was this woman there, she was about 19. She was a colored woman. She'd had about 5 children, and she had tattooed all the way down her arm, "I love Ben," and then dot, 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 dot. "I love Peter," dot, 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 dot. "I love John," dot, 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 all the way down from her shoulder to her elbow. And she'd had 4 children, a couple of miscarriages. She was in hospital because she'd been drunk. People drink a form of almost pure alcohol. She'd drunk that, so she was drunk, so a car knocked her over, and so she'd broken her leg. She was discharged after a couple of weeks, and on her crutches, she was just discharged. People literally sort of said, "Okay, you can go now." So she walks on her crutches, and just below the hospital, there's a graveyard where all these people sit, where a whole lot of people sit and drink this alcohol. So she got drunk again, wandered across the highway, oops, other leg broken. So she was back in hospital. And that's what I mean about a curative care and preventative care. There's none of the preventative care given. People are not educated. They just fixed up, and then, thank goodness we've got rid of you. Actually, 3 people want this bed, so just out of sight, out of mind. Let's have the next one in. But that prevention, the reason why the government hasn't got into this preventative aspect of medicine is because it's so threatening, because it challenges the whole social system. Why does somebody like her go out immediately she's released from hospital and get drunk? The fact is that she's got no home to go to. She lives such a miserable existence. The more hours she can spend drunk, the better for her. They're not prepared to actually cope with the bigger issues which health poses. So what I'm saying is that preventative medicine is where health should be directed, in, not only in South Africa, but in the whole of Africa and in the third world. Let me give you an example. Sort of every day, no, about say twice a week, a mother will come screaming into us with a child gasping. And it's a case of everything gets dropped, this child has to be rushed to hospital. So chaos, get the child into hospital and off we, get the child in the car and off we scream to hospital. The child is dehydrated, and as soon as they get to hospital, we just roar into the emergency unit, and the doctor just takes one look, says, right, child dehydrated, puts up a drip straight into the scalp, immediately water into the child as fast as they can, and usually the child will be better. Sometimes they die. But the reason about why that baby has dehydration is what's not actually dealt with. And this is where the small group of people I work with, this is the way in which we're starting to work now. When I work with a team of, we were 30 people working in this one squatter camp called Crossroads. When we were working there, our doctors were seeing about 300 patients a day. There were about four or five of them, so it was about 60 or 70 patients a day. And the diseases they were seeing was this kind of thing. It was either dehydration, or it was diarrhea, or it was tuberculosis, or it was flu, or something like that. Very simple, repetitive diseases. And they just went like almost out their minds. You can just imagine, 70 of these a day. And we started to really think, it's not actually necessary for a doctor to diagnose that. You don't actually need 7 years training to be able to say you've got a cold or you've got diarrhea. And in fact, it's encouraging the myth of people coming to the white doctor and getting cured and actually not taking that responsibility for themselves. So the way we started to work was to get a group of houses together to elect one person who would be the community health worker. And we would train that person to be able to diagnose and to treat in the case of a simple disease, and also to educate people. So that when a mother came to the community health worker with her child if the child was very ill, it would be brought to the clinic and we would still take them to hospital. If the child was just starting with diarrhea, the community health worker would explain why the child had diarrhea, give them a rehydration drink, but also maybe the next day go and visit the mother and explain to her that the reason why the baby had diarrhea was because of the fact that the toilet bucket was just outside the door, and maybe that wasn't the best place to put it. And after they'd been working for a few months, they were sort of able to organize in their community and possibly ask one person to move their shack from a certain area to another so that all the buckets could be kept in one area slightly away from the rest of the houses. And after a few months after that, we're able to start saying to people, do you realize why it's actually us who have to have these buckets, us as black people, and start to bring in the political awareness into health? And that's what we call primary health care. So that we were actually starting to deal with the real causes of disease and get the community to actually take responsibility for coping with them themselves. Of course, it's also at this level that you can also interact. That thing, Megan, you were saying of traditional healers, you can bring that in as well, because if a baby has diarrhea, the mother will take it to a traditional healer who will give them an enema to give to the baby to get rid of the evil spirit causing diarrhea. But you can imagine an enema on diarrhea, you know. It's no wonder the child gets dehydrated in about 2 hours. And so these community health workers who were part of the community, who had the same respect for traditional healers as the rest of the community, are then in a much better position to be able to explain why the cure that they've always relied on, or not to explain it away, but to possibly question it and say, why don't you try what I've got for you instead, just this once? I thought I'd start off this next section about immunization. A few people here have asked me, what about AIDS in South Africa? It's such a big issue here. What's the situation in South Africa? And AIDS has just come to South Africa. I think it's just this year that we've had 4 deaths from AIDS. It's not... You know, I don't know. I don't actually know who it is.
I've heard in black Africa it's a little epidemic.
Yes. It's not... AIDS doesn't originate in South Africa. It's tending to come much more from North and West Africa. And in fact, our AIDS is coming down with people from Malawi. Migrant workers who come to work on the mines are bringing AIDS with them. There's concern in South Africa about AIDS, but not nearly to the same extent that there is here. And I think the reason for that is that we still have epidemics. We have cholera epidemics, we have measles epidemics, we have polio epidemics every year. So another epidemic, what's that? You know, it doesn't matter whatever it is, we're used to them. It's almost as if death is much more a part of life in the whole of Africa and in South Africa than it is here. So we're not going to get totally neurotic about AIDS when people are dying of other epidemics as well. But there is research going on about AIDS. The problem is with the black population, the refusal to use condoms at all. And so it's very difficult to know how to go about coping with it. And I thought I'd use that just as an introduction into immunization. The fact that, why do we have these epidemics? It's because of the poor immunization. And, you know, I don't know, I can't remember which vaccine it is at the moment, but there's supposed to be something which gives you immunization against rheumatic fever. And that's just not done. So many people are actually not immunized against that. If you don't live near to a hospital, you won't be able to have that immunization as a child. Or you might have one of the 3 immunization injections that you're supposed to have. So you wouldn't have those, so you wouldn't be immunized. So maybe at 20, you'd actually have to have a heart valve replacement. And it's not uncommon for a person to actually come in and actually to have 2 valves replaced from rheumatic fever. And they do, at Groteskeer, maybe 10 valve replacements a week at the cost of $7,500 for each valve, $7,500 for each valve. So now nobody's got enough money, so the government thinks, well, we have to cut down on medical expenditure, immunization campaigns are costing too much. So our TB budget has just been reduced by 40 million rand, but not to worry, we're still doing valve replacements, 10 a week, 7,500 a valve. So that's where you can maybe see our government's priorities in terms of health care and understanding of the situation are completely bananas. But you can also understand why, therefore, we did the first heart transplant in the world because of everybody there was to practice on. So it can be basically summed up in health care is totally orientated into saving people's lives, but it's not actually concerned with the care of quality of people's lives. It was so frustrating for me as a physical therapist working with stroke patients predominantly, working in a hospital where somebody would be brought in unconscious, no problem, you know, we'd put them on a ventilator, we'd get them back living, whatever they wanted to do, we'd make sure that they were living. Then they were discharged home, maybe unable to walk, but as long as they were living, we never had to see them again. And as a hospital person, I wasn't allowed to go into their homes to actually treat them. So we treat them frantically in the hospital while they were there for a week, 1 week, and then we never see them again. So there's no rehabilitation. There's no concern for the quality of life. And I think maybe you can also see from what I've said that it's not only overt violence that we see in health, but also the covert violence. What I was talking about here of the research and what's actually going on in the hospitals. And I think that's all I have to say. Are there any questions? Well, maybe you can explain it to me. I'm sort of under the impression that I'd be terrified to do anything because I might do it wrong and then I'll get sued for it.
For malpractice.
Yeah. And it's so different for us of a case of... It's also the money issue. I'd never think of treating somebody in terms of money.
Well, there's our share of doctors who will not treat people because they don't have insurance. But you know, there's also the share who will take anybody. And the hospital I work at absorbs hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for people who can't pay. I mean, they're just there. And
oh, really?
Treat them, and we just discharged a patient from my unit who was way over $100,000 from a gunshot wound. He's treated and released and sent to another hospital for further rehabilitation and stuff, and we just ate it, you know, we absorb it. And it's not always convenient. Sometimes they'll go send us to another hospital. We won't take them here because this is a profit hospital, not a not-profit. And that's aggravating sometimes. You know, to see patients refuse, but this sounds terrifying to me.
Yes,
the kind of,
yeah.
You know, just blatant treatment to a certain type of person. Ours, unfortunately, it's still kind of hidden. Not everybody knows what happens sometimes, unless you work in the system. You know, that prejudice is there. It's not as open, maybe, but I don't think it's as prevalent.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be afraid that I wouldn't be treated somewhere.
Right.
Don't people who can't afford it have, you know, medical coupons or something like that? And the government help out with their case?
Medicare paid $1,700 out of the $100,000 the patient we had. So it's, you know, it's not always very much.
Yes, you had a question.
When you're talking about the lack of immunization and so on, and the epidemics, does that affect just the black people, or the black and white people? Or I wasn't clear on that. Whether do the white people get immunizations, but not the black, or is it inadequate everywhere?
You know, maybe I didn't make that very clear. It is, it's not that blatant. I mean, I actually know the system because I've worked in it for, like, trained in it, and then I worked in it. Mm-hmm. Like, immunization is available, but it's available. If vaccine's put in a central hospital, you actually have to have a car or you've got to have money to get to that vaccine. Mm-hmm. And so white children would tend to be very well immunized. And it tends to be black children not immunized, also in the rural areas. Like, mobile teams will go out, but they'll go out today and then they'll run out of vaccine, and so they won't go until next year. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, three injections have to be given, and the children are only given one, so they can still actually pick up the diseases.
There aren't different levels. Like here, you could go to your private pediatrician and spend $25 or $30 and have your kid immunized. Or you could go to the health department. Most cities, all the health departments have immunizations for $4 or $5. You know, for that difference, mm-hmm. or to try to help with the poorer populations, is that kind of choice there? If you can't get it at the hospital, can you get it somewhere else?
Well, for me, that's a choice.
The
black population, I mean, most people, that's just absolutely not a choice, because if they live in an urban area, the only place they can go to is the healthcare system, is the health center, the government divisional council, they call it. But if you don't know your child has to be immunized, why would you go? And if you're living rurally, you might live 100 miles from a hospital. You might live even further. And that's your only option.
So our health departments, which maybe promote preventative care and education to the community, there isn't something similar to that in South Africa. That's what you're saying you need. There is an organization that's teaching the community what they need to take care of themselves, like immunizations.
Education
isn't there.
The Divisional Council will say they are doing that. And I suppose in their very limited way, they are to an extent, that a mother will be told or she must come back for immunization. But they're not educated as to why. And I mean, if your budget's just been cut an enormous amount, you know, what I'm trying to say is it is being done. The sort of the tip of the iceberg's being tackled. But it actually needs a lot more thought, a lot more energy, a lot more money to actually deal with the whole problem. And it's not actually being made a priority. And so that's why it's not getting done. And it's at that level sort of immunization that you actually need like mass drives to actually make sure that it gets done.
Like a few valve replacements they could do.
Yes.
A number of massive drives.
For sure. Yeah. Yes.
Now, since I didn't hear you say anything about starvation or malnutrition, is it safe to say that the disease is much a greater a factor in human suffering than hunger in South Africa?
So is starvation a greater cause of disease than... Could you say that again?
Yeah, I was just wondering which was greater, human suffering in South Africa. Is it from hunger or is it from disease?
The trouble is the two are so interrelated. Because if you're not getting enough food, you're going to have such a low resistance that you're very likely to pick up disease. And so your chance of picking up disease is so much greater. So there is a lot of malnutrition, but... And that's tackled at that level, but that leads to diseases.
Now, malnutrition, is that unbalanced diet or no diet at all? I mean, no food at all?
Well, they're the two classic diseases, kwashiorkor and marasmus. And you'll have to correct me, I can't remember which is which right now. The one is, I think it's marasmus is the protein deficiency. Is that right? Right. Marasmus is the protein deficiency and kwashiorkor is just not enough of anything. But both of them, I mean, it's most expensive to buy protein. So both of them are actually diseases of, it's not enough. Yeah. But that's actually, it's on the increase at the moment. Even in the squatter camp where I work, it's 15 miles outside the centre of Cape Town. There's tremendous malnourishment there. It's quite frightening. There are a couple, but can you imagine that if there are 300,000 people, how far that kind of aid gets? And it's the trouble is that if you give a loaf of bread today, what's the point of it? That woman needs another loaf tomorrow. And in fact, for the rest of that child's life, which the child may be 1 month.
So is the government just, you're on your own? Telling the population you're on your own?
No, it's even worse. They get the army, the soldiers, to give out the bread. And then those same soldiers will shoot the elder brothers and sisters if there's trouble. It's part of a ploy by the government to get the army accepted as people by the township who are trying to help them. So I remember being in one township, which is quite a way outside Cape Town, which was basically patrolled by the police for 7 months. And there were police, there were the army, were patrolling up and down the streets at the interval from me to you. with their guns ready. And every, like, we were just sitting there. It was actually in a clinic. And something ran across the road, and a soldier just turned around and fired at it, and it was a cat. So there was just this immediate, like, machine gun retort. That was on the one side of the road. And on the other side of the road, the soldiers were handing out bread and sweets to the children.
The government?
Yes, we are. Yes, so we have to go very slowly. Also, it's a very slow process. It's not a process which takes a couple of months or 2 years. Mm-hmm. It's a very long-term process. And I suppose in a way we feel if we actually want to carry on our work, we've got to work in this really slow way. And it's actually up to people to start picking that up themselves. We can cast a few little ideas, but it's actually up to people themselves to start getting there. But I think you'll understand when I say that with squatters, the primary problem is, where's my next meal coming from? They're not interested in that much political activity. For them, it's just, this child must be fed. It is a transient population, because not only are people getting short-term employment and moving out and then moving back, but also they're going back to the homelands, going back to the rural areas and then coming back. But people, I mean, we've had squatters in Cape Town now for 11 years, and they have people who've been squatting like that for 11 years. Yeah.
How long has this condition existed in Africa, ma'am?
Which condition?
The present condition. How long has it existed in Africa? Does it seem to be improving, or does it seem to be worsening?
Well, I can't really answer for Africa. I know I can answer for... The only area I really know is Cape Town, and the things are getting worse now because unemployment is increasing, because the number of people... Because in the rural areas there's been a time of drought, people are tending to move more to the city in desperation to get food and money. And so the situation is actually worsening. I'm afraid you're right. It's poor land management and practices. It's a case of so many people have actually been told, you belong in the homelands, that there's actually overcrowding in a rural area, if you know what I mean. But it's also climatic. We've got a desert in the middle of South Africa, and that seems to be expanding, and so that's a problem. But then if the rains come, because of the poor land management, it just creates enormous soil erosion. So, yeah.
Well, what gets me is to see a string of these people going into town. One lady will be leading one, she'll be pregnant, carrying one in their arms, and two or three falling there. Isn't there any management at all in that condition? It's like an animal going to town, you know, they get you.
You know, I think it's not only a problem in South Africa or Africa, it's all over the world. It's almost a class problem. It's not really a racial problem. And, well, let me speak now about South Africa. A black woman it's understood that the more children she has, the more people there will be to look after her when she gets older. And that's why children are important. I hate to use the word commodity, but they value, yes, a very important investment. And the government we were talking about the divisional council earlier on, which runs preventative healthcare. By far their greatest emphasis is on birth control. But it's not done with very much understanding of the population's needs. And it's also done in quite a blatant way. I was telling people last week of how the injection which is used, which can make a woman infertile for 3 months, is an injection which is been banned here in the United States because it's dangerous. I think it's pushed more for black people. It's encouraged, the use of it's encouraged, whereas for white people it wouldn't be encouraged. It would be available, but you'd actually have to say, I want that, for them to give it to you. It's a small proportion, but it is slowly increasing, of doctors and nurses. One of the government's aims is to create a black middle class. By doing that, they hope to create a buffer zone, so that in a time of unrest, those people who actually have something to lose will actually support the government. So there are an increasing number of black sisters, black doctors, but the trouble is they tend to work in state-run institutions, and in a way be even, I don't know how to explain it, but how if somebody comes out of a lower class, it's so important to them, the fact that they've risen a class, and actually be so unkind and uncompassionate about the conditions they're dealing with. So at these divisional council clinics, which do the immunization and the birth control, it will be run predominantly by black sisters. If a woman comes in there and says, you know, an ordinary black woman comes in and says, look at my child, it's ill, a black sister will look at the child and just start screaming at the mother. No wonder your child's ill. This child hasn't been immunized. How can you expect us to take care for your child if you don't care about the child enough to immunize it? And besides that, you haven't washed the child this morning. What kind of a mother are you? And so, of course, there's no understanding of this chain of diseases, as I was saying, and it's rather a sort of, look, I wash myself, what's wrong with you? The fact that woman's actually had to stand in the queue to get seen at the clinic since 5 o'clock in the morning is not even mentioned. So it's a very difficult issue. It is, to a certain extent. Actually, what's happening with sanctions is that an American company, say, like Xerox, will withdraw. But actually, South African business will take that over. So There is a case of some companies like Kodak withdrawing completely, and then there is some unemployment because of that. But most companies seem to be being taken over by South African companies. The unemployment is because of the general economics.
So sanctions really aren't affecting you that much.
They are. It's the general. I don't know. It's sort of like the South African economy is going like this already. Sanctions are making it go a bit worse. But it's going down already, and I think that's the reason for unemployment. I don't know, Steve, what you feel. I think it has. I think it's they were maybe smaller. Say 20 years ago, there were much fewer people doing it because there were fewer people, but also because it's only in the last, say, 10 years that the homelands have become much more clearly defined border-wise, and people have been so strictly sent back. And so there's actually much less space for people to be in a rural environment. And also because of these things we were talking about, land practice and droughts and that kind of thing. Are there any more questions? Because Steve was just going to say a bit about this theology linking up with this. I didn't really know how to say it, so he was going to say it.
Yeah, I just wanted to use this as an illustration to go into the discussion tomorrow, which will be on the Kairos document, and I'd hope people might be interested in doing that. And you can pick up a copy in the bookstore for $2.95. But I wanted to show, using this and Vespers last night as a good example of a theological issue. If you remember in Vespers last night, the preacher talked about the children who had medical problems. The one had some brain damage, the one was bitten, and they were able to find the health care for that, and that was thanking God for God's help in that, You remember the thing about that? Now, I just wanted to say that for a black woman in a squatter camp whose child dies because of malnutrition and prays just as hard, what is the... Can you see the theological issue that raises? Because the only difference between the squatter woman and the person in the first world, let's just taking it out of those specific examples, but first world, third world, is that then God basically helps me because I can speak English and I'm white-skinned and we have the technology. And God doesn't like the black squatter woman because God's spirit hardly ever seems to come and help the medical problems that that person has. And that raises some of the questions that theologians in the third world have been raising about the way the first world has linked its theology and its technology and its drive for bigger and better with the spirit of God. And it's one of the things that the Kairos document sharpens. It doesn't really talk about health, but I think this is a good way in. So if you're interested in seeing some of the stuff that third world theologians and Christians are grappling with about the fact that God doesn't seem to provide ambulances when one prays to God, perhaps we could have a good discussion about that tomorrow. And I do want to say I found the sermon last night inspirational, and I think there was a lot of meaning in that, but to show how that could really become a theological problem when you don't have hospitals to save that. And the last thing that just occurred to me is that one of the interesting things about African traditional healers is that they've, while the first world has always got amused by their not being able to deal with this and seeking the causes in family relations or in evil spirits, more and more medical people are discovering that in fact it's chains of events, and it is family relationships, and it is often what we call psychosomatic diseases, where it's the spirit more than that, and that actually is far more of a Christian way of looking at health than perhaps any other. So that just occurred to me. But thank you.